this fall's institute, entitled Viewing the South from a 21st Century Perspective, the New Encyclopedia of Southern Culture. The Filson's mission is to collect, preserve, and tell the significant stories of Kentucky and the Ohio Valley region's history and culture. I think it's appropriate that this institute, which discusses the significant changes in the South that the South has experienced and still faces, is based on the New Encyclopedia of Southern Culture. This is a topic that is certainly relevant. And when we think about our past and future, our art and architecture, our foodways, our diversity, and our music, that is certainly relevant. We encounter these on a daily basis. It's my pleasure this time to introduce our keynote speaker, Dr. Charles Reagan Wilson, Kelly Jean Cook, Senior Chair of History and Professor of Southern Studies at the University of Mississippi. His lecture is entitled, The 21st Century South, What the New Encyclopedia of Southern Culture Tells Us About the Burden of the Southern Future. A native of Tennessee, Dr. Wilson grew up in Texas, earning his doctorate in United States history from the University of Texas at Austin. He has taught at the University of Mississippi since 1981. He served as director of the Center for the Study of Southern Culture from 1998 to 2007. Prior to his tenure at the University of Mississippi, he taught at the University of Texas at El Paso, Texas Tech University, the University of Würzburg, and the University of Mainz in Germany. Now, he is the author of numerous books and articles, including Baptized in Blood, The Religion of the Lost Cause, 1865 to 1920, Judgment and Grace in Dixie, Southern Faiths from Faulkner to Elvis, and Flashes of a Southern Spirit, Meanings of the Spirit in the U.S. South. He is currently working on The Southern Way of Life, Meanings of Culture and Civilization in the U.S. South. So please join me in welcoming to the Filson, Dr. Charles Reagan Wilson.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you, Mark, for that wonderful introduction. I've known Mark a long time, fellow historians, and I want to thank Judy Miller for her work in setting up this conference and making us all feel so welcome. I want to thank all of you all for coming. I'm pleased to be here at this august institution, which I've known about for a long time, and glad to be in this spot of the South. Now, I remember that I know the debate about is Kentucky Southern is one that goes on, has gone on for a long time. But those of us in Southern studies, I want you to know, claim it. So, I have been talking to enough audiences to know that when a professor stands up, a historian, you wonder just how long is this fellow going to talk? Well, it reminds me of one of my favorite stories, one of the favorite things that I have done. When I was director of the center, which Mark mentioned, I had the great privilege of making B.B. King an honorary Southern Studies professor. Now, B.B. is a famous Mississippian, of course, from Indianola, and he was doing a benefit concert for Living Blues Magazine, which our center publishes. So we had at the center, various people, the bright idea of making him an honorary professor. So we had a plaque made up, Chancellor gave it to him, we had a little press conference, and he was answering questions. And he went on a little too long with one of his answers, but he caught himself and said, I'm sorry, but then again, I am a professor. Well, I promise not to go on too long, but I want to begin with a famous historian, C. Van Woodward. In 1960, Woodward published a seminal volume of essays called The Burden of Southern History, exploring the Southern regional identity, arguing that the historical experience of the people of the South was the only basis for a continuing regional distinctiveness. With the dramatic changes of the civil rights movement only a few years away, Woodward seemed to be looking to the past to point the region toward a resource as it negotiated what he saw as a future of social change. It was not only changes in race relations, but changes in the economy that would challenge the future South of his time. The symbol of innovation is inescapable, he wrote, identifying the bulldozer as a new symbol of Southern change. The roar and groan and dust of it, Woodward wrote, "Greet one on the outskirts of every southern city." This was 1960. "This bulldozer revolution," he called it, "demolishes the old to make way for the new. The machine symbolized the revolution in several ways. In its favored area of operation, the area where city meets country, in its relentless speed, in its supreme disregard for obstacles, in its heedless methods, in what it demolishes, and in what it builds." Well, looking back on it, Woodward was undoubtedly correct that the bulldozer revolution changed the South, but it seems a dated symbol now in an era in the 21st century where the major form of innovation is not a machine that roars and groans and dusts it up, but a computer, or to be more 20th century, an iPad that connects the user quietly to the World Wide Web. In any event, in his essay, The Search for Southern Identity, Woodward proposed history as the basis for a mid-20th century Southern identity, seen in the South's legacy of poverty, defeat, and failure in the Civil War, the moral guilt over slavery and racial segregation in a nation dedicated to the creed that all men are created equal, and he saw a sense of place as distinctive in the South, in a nation that's swirling about seemingly in constant movement. All these experiences represented a burden of Southern history that would forever make it different than the rest of the United States. Well, the tendency to think about the South's future is a long one. One could surely go back to the beginning of the Civil War, with white Confederates and African Americans sharing in different ways a hopeful optimism of coming change, whether a future of independence and self-determination for white Southerners, or a future of freedom from slavery and new self-determination for slaves if the Union won the Civil War. Consider the words of Robert Barnwell Rhett when South Carolina seceded. It seems especially ironic and appropriate today that he was in 1861 picturing, he said, the historian of the year 2000, writing this passage about the bold dreams of the antebellum South, quote, "and extending their empire across this continent to the Pacific and down through Mexico to the other side of the Great Gulf and over the Isles of the Sea, they," meaning white Southerners, "would establish an empire if the Confederacy succeeds and wrought out a civilization which has never been equaled or surpassed, a civilization teeming with orators, poets, philosophers, statesmen, and historians equal to those of Greece and Rome, and presented to the world the glorious spectacle of a free, prosperous, and illustrious people," unquote. Well, one can only stand stunned at this passage and its dream about what would happen in terms of a worldwide conquest of the South if the Confederacy had won. By the end of the war, though, white and black Southerners had different readings of the future. The defeated Confederates saw an apocalyptic future, fearing their social death, while African Americans faced Reconstruction with a hopefulness of achieving the full meaning of freedom. By the turn of the 20th century, white Southerners had recovered their optimism and looked confidently toward a future within the United States that now accepted their hegemony over Southern racial matters. A 12-volume series of books called The South and the Building of the Nation appeared in 1909, about a century ago. And the writer saw the South's future as a productive one within the nation. Scholar William Trent wrote the introduction for the volume on the South's intellectual life, and he predicted, quote, "the advantage the South's classical tradition ought to give its writers, and to express the hope that when some future generation undertakes in a work like the present to survey the achievement of the section, the volumes devoted to literature will register a progress commensurate with all reasonable wishes and expectations around the classical tradition and its influence." Of course, honestly, we hardly talk about the South's classical tradition now, although we can say our literature volume of the New Encyclopedia of Southern Culture surely does register the progress in writing in the South, to repeat Trent's language, but it was the convulsion of early 20th century modernist thought and social change that brought the Southern literary renaissance and what Alan Tate called a look backward as the South was changing. Thus, the dangers of prediction of the future. Meanwhile, around the time Trent was writing, W.E.B. Du Bois, the African-American intellectual, was meditating on the souls of black folk and making his own predictions that the problem of the future of the 20th century would be the color line, a prediction more accurate than that of Robert Barnwell Rhett or William Trent. The Great Depression brought a crisis to American culture, including the South, and it led to more ponderings of the region's future in the interwar years. In 1931, historian Howard Mumford Jones wrote an essay entitled "The Future of Southern Culture." He summarized Southern culture at that point in 1931 this way. "Thus, a region organized around an agrarian economy, characterized by cultural diversity, by kindliness, by a personalized relationship among individuals, by an interest in living for its own sake, and by an easygoing do philosophy, having survived the Civil War and Reconstruction, now finds itself in the 20th century confronted by a new cultural problem, the problem of industrialization. Jones predicted that the diversities of culture which have heretofore characterized this vast region are now threatened by a mechanical civilization in standard parts. Still, he had faith in what he called the Young South, working toward the creation and development of better commonwealths on a program of a balanced agrarian and industrial life. Howard Mumford Jones's vision of the Southern future came partly out of the two main intellectual trends of the 1930s South, that of the Vanderbilt agrarians, whose 1930 symposium, I'll Take My Stand, had posited endangered agrarian values they assumed that had traditionally defined the South, and on the other hand, that of social scientists of the time led by North Carolina sociologist Howard Odum, who saw the need for regional planning, for a balance between agrarian and industrial development and values for the Southern future. A few years later, in 1939, Louisiana writer Hamilton Basso wrote an essay called The Future of the South. You can see I've had fun looking at things with that title, The Future of the South, for the Liberal New Republic magazine. He posited that the South is a state of mind, rather than any oneness born of regionalism that makes the South. He gave his view of how that state of mind developed. In the years immediately following the Civil War, it was principally determined by hatred. Hatred of the South yielded to bitterness, a bitterness that caused the former leaders of the South to retreat into a dim half-world of memory and remorse. And after bitterness came distrust. Distrust is slowly passing, for more and more the realization is being forced upon us that we are a part of the United States, but some of the old bitterness yet remains, unrealized perhaps, reflected in our prejudices and our passions as well. Forget this state of mind, he warned. Dwell only on the bleached bones of charts and indices, and you forget the living temper of a people, a temper that will help shape the future as it helped shape the past. Basso wrote that it is from this threshold of awareness of problems of the South that we face the future. The future of the South obviously cannot be disassociated from the future of the nation. The nation faced challenges from fascism and communism, and to continue, it must achieve some lasting balance between individualism and socializations by means of a planned and orderly transitional democracy. The older pattern of Southern life, in any event, he said, had been shattered beyond recognition by the forces of history. That phrase, forces of history, seems to presage Woodward's burden of the Southern past. Southerners must understand that they cannot assume their earlier tradition to be living and valid, Basso wrote in 1939, when the region's leaders are newly rich people, I like this, whose fortunes have been sucked up from the oil wells of Coca-Cola. So in the end, Basso's prediction for the Southern future in 1939 was a few nightmares as well as a few dreams. But we may validly hope in the nation and in the South that there will be recorded such compelling dreams as men have recorded in the past, those inner visions which through the alchemy of art and artist have become part of the living dream of not only the South, but humankind. Flash forward now to the early 1970s, only a decade after Woodward's essay on the burden of Southern history, and we find a biracial group of progressive Southerners, members of the L.Q.C. Lamar Society. L.Q.C. Lamar was a post-Civil War Southern Mississippi historian, senator, United States senator. Well, the 1970s Lamar Society members saw their moment in time, namely the early post-Jim Crow years, as ripe with possibilities for the future. They were writers, journalists, politicians, policymakers. They saw the future of the South as one of planned progress. The South's late economic development at that point, historical legacy of defeat and questioning of nationalistic presumptions, and its tortured but seemingly now redeemed race relations with the end of Jim Crow, would position the South to lead the nation more broadly into the future. They drew from Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, with its imagining in 1963 of a redeemed South where black children and white children would work together in the future. Writer Willie Morris's introduction to the symposium, You Can't Eat Magnolias, it's a great title, isn't it? Explained that in the unifying theme which undergirds this various collection is that out of a meaningful working partnership between whites and blacks, the South stands an exceptionally good chance of solving its old egregious faults and its more contemporary ones, while both preserving the best in its own unique heritage and offering more than a few crucial lessons to other Americans. That volume had a whole section of essays entitled The Southern Future. And the title of the North Carolina of North Carolina Governor Terry Sanford's essay told it best. The title of his article was "The End of Myths: The South Can Lead the Nations," not just nation, but the nations. By getting away from the Southern legend of the old South romanticism and racial intolerance, he wrote, "The South could lead the nations, plural." The volume expressed the long Southern intellectual tradition of seeing the region having a mission, usually a redemptive one. And it expressed the way the concept of the South could evoke moral meanings, sometimes immorality and a benighted South, but often a region whose best qualities gave it spiritual and moral insight that the more materialistic and successful American nation did not otherwise have. C. Van Woodward himself weighed in on the South's future in this era as well. In September 1976, Time magazine had a special issue entitled "The South Today." It was in light of George and Jimmy Carter winning the 1976 Democratic Party presidential nomination. And the issue offered an altogether glowing assessment of a South, poised for achievement, only a decade after the dramatic changes in the region's racial and economic situation. Woodward's essay in the issue is called "The South Tomorrow." And it argued for more than He argued that for more than three generations after the Civil War, the balance of trade and cultural influences went heavily against the South. But he saw in the 1970s this changing. Changes had already brought an end to Southern isolation and defensiveness within the nation, opening the way for what he called the Southernization of America and the Americanization of the South, as North and South moved closer together. Still, he predicted in 1976 that much of the old Southern distinctiveness would be retained, including things not readily quantifiable, he wrote, such as the old courtesy, the antique personalism, the familial ambiance, the love of place, the abhorrence of abstraction, the fear of being computerized. Remember the iPad, the 21st century. Significantly, Woodward, like the Lamar Society writers of the 1970s, saw all these down-home ways as representing the instincts of black Southerners as well as white. These ways were part and parcel, he concluded, of a common regional subculture hammered out between the two oldest, largest, and most distinctive American minorities of all, the white Southerner and the African Americans, during their centuries of Southern experience. In closing his essay, Woodward got back to the idea of Southern burden. He noted that for 32 of the first 36 years of the Republic, the South held the presidency and the predominance of power. It managed to govern the country with some distinction in those early days of the Republic, in spite of the burden of slavery on its back and one hand tied behind the black hand. With the burden removed, with both hands free, it might do even better should its chance come again. In retrospect, Woodward seems prescient in mentioning the presidency. Southerners held the office of the presidency for 20 out of the 34 years after Carter's election. So indeed, as Woodward had predicted, this was a very telling thing that the South was back in power. Whether, however, that fulfilled Carter's hope of better governance under Southern leadership, I'm not so sure about. It's problematic. But this was a hopeful, shining Southern optimism of these 1970s commentators thinking about the future of the South. If those moments in time I have reviewed produce speculations on the future of the South, it seems we live in another such age. The new Encyclopedia of Southern Culture has appeared in the early 21st century and surely reflects the era it is in. We like to think that scholarship and especially reference works are timeless, but though we strive for accuracy, authority, and comprehensiveness, encyclopedias come out of the intellectual and other concerns of the times when they are researched and written. Planning for the new encyclopedia began at the turn of the 21st century, and so we can claim to be a millennial, as they call the generation coming of age now. I have been reflecting on our volumes in terms of their relationship to the 21st century, and I want to share some of my thoughts with you tonight. Of course, the encyclopedia was not planned as an interpretation or argument about the 21st century. Still, in considering a new edition of the original encyclopedia that came out in 1989, one of our guiding principles was to search for new material that reflected scholarly concerns and the intellectual interest in general of the contemporary period, the 21st century. Perhaps the most important theme in that regard is globalization. That topic is considered at numerous points across the volumes, from the viewpoint of history, the economy, literature, and in other forms of culture. As James Peacock and Kerry Matthews write in one article on globalization, globalization is the integration of the world, economically, politically, and culturally. Globalization has local impacts in each of those areas. It creates diversity as people, goods, and ideas migrate from one place to another. Globalization is not just capitalism, booming when the economy booms, disappearing when it falters, as in recent times. It is also an attitude. Recent data suggests that Southerners tend toward a global attitude, he argues, but Southern and global are not tangible things, absolute conditions, but tendencies. Southernism is defined culturally, historically, economically, psychologically, and geographically as a concern and identification with the South. Globalism is a concern and identity with the wider world. The two concerns and identities can clash, but also overlap and interweave. A 2002 Southern Focus poll in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution suggests that some Southerners see themselves as both different from non-Southerners and connected to the world as a whole. When asked whether they see themselves primarily as different from non-Southerners or linked to people around the world, surprisingly, nearly 50% of respondents answered they felt they were connected to people around the world. Truly a changing attitude from 50 years or more earlier. The peculiar positioning of the South in the global world is significant. The South is a distinctive player within the American role of global leader. The South is a special connection to the Third World, for example, for the South itself was a Third World nation in its plantation days. Studies show how the South as a plantation system in the past displayed strong similarities to and differences from Russian and Prussian estate owners, Junkers of East Germany, and colonial plantation-based societies in the Caribbean, Latin America, and other places. The South is a unique overlap of a white majority and a plantation society. That's very unheard of in world history. The South can be seen as the northernmost extension of the plantation system of South America and the Caribbean, and the southernmost extension of a dominant northern European culture. The South is surely one example of a more general pattern of plantation-based society with a colonial background. And my favorite example of this, trying to make the connection between the South and the Caribbean, for example, as a kind of transnational area, came in the 1990s when Bill Clinton was president. And he went to this conference in the Caribbean, and Gabriel Marquez, the great Latin American writer, got up and said that Bill Clinton is one of us. You know, that he's part of this arc of a plantation southern world that unites the American South and the Caribbean, and praised him and for his love of music and the literatures of, you know, Faulkner influenced Marquez and the connections of our writers. And of course, Bill Clinton lit a cigar and said, "I agree." But if the South has this kind of positioning in this global world, that's not the whole story. The South has also had many first world, or what we might call North, features. The Bank of America, finance is surely a northern thing historically. The Bank of America is the nation's second largest bank. Charlotte is its corporate home, and it ranks second after New York in banking assets. And when you consider its output, the South represents the fourth largest economy in the world if you factor out all of the Southern productivity. Southern products and services flow around the globe. Coca-Cola, cigarettes, CNN, Delta Airlines. In religion, missionaries have a long history and continue to represent the South, Southern denominations around the world. Well, this article on globalization and the economy is intriguing and culture because it focuses not only on such tangible things as we've just mentioned, but also on values. Certain experiences and values define the South as potentially a mediating force between the United States and much of the world, especially other Souths, whether South Asia, South Africa, South America. Blues and bluegrass music, Cajun New Orleans dishes, grits and cornbread are identified as Southern, and the music conveys messages, spirituals with their deep themes, and we shall overcome. The authors of one of our globalization articles argue that the lessons of life that the South can convey derive from its burden of history, directly referring to Woodward's argument, including not only of war and defeat and the experience of being colonized, but also internal problems relating to position of minorities. And the South, though, embodies values, traditions of kinship, family, community, and the valuing of a sense of place. These experiences and qualities are distinctive, yet also similar to other places that are call themselves Southern places around the world, whether in Europe, Southern Italy, Southern Germany, Scotland is the South, in a weird kind of geographical twist, in Britain. Finally, this article argues that the South makes a particular contribution to globalism by buttressing the sense of place. Now, sense of place is a very contested term in Southern studies. It's long been seen as a prime signifier of Southern distinctiveness, but many see the sense of place as only a social construction without much material meaning these days. But our authors of this article enter this discussion smartly by focusing on ecological issues. Paradoxically, they write, abstract ethics that ignore place and environment have fostered the destruction of the earth. They define mission and exploit place simply to achieve it. Alternative values associated with the Southern counterculture of ecological concern value the earth, including the places we inhabit, and preserve and sustain it as an ultimate value of in itself. This is a Southern contribution to global concerns. Catherine McKee, a good Kentuckian, one of our colleagues at the University of Mississippi from Graduate of Center College, in her article on globalization in Southern literature, notes that reading across the artificially constructed but very real political boundaries of government, scholars of the global South find particularly useful the perspectives of post-colonial theory that allow them to recognize similar hierarchies in seemingly dissimilar places. Global South studies then might examine racial practices in river deltas across the globe. It might consider how religious fundamentalism varies by location, and it can be found in Jewish traditions in the Middle East and Islamic conditions in the Middle East as well as in the United States. The goal of focusing on a global South, she says, is not to erase the U.S.'s claim to a distinctive sort of Americanism, but rather to understand that persistent sense of difference North-South as a means of connection to global patterns of human behavior, that we have things in common with other places around the world. So globalization as a topic reveals much about the 21st century South and its broadened perspectives. Our articles in particular mention Woodward's burden and argue for its continued relevance in linking Southern experiences to the world. The 21st century will be one dominated by various forms of multimedia, and the media volume of our new encyclopedia engages those for us. Film, TV, and photography have long provided compelling images and stories about the South, but they are often marred by stereotyped representations. One of our articles on television series about the South analyzes recent shows such as True Blood, set in the Deep South and harnessing older images of violence and sensuality, but doing so now by exploiting the peculiar contemporary fascination with vampire tales. True Blood may also be read as exploring civil rights themes with vampires symbolically playing the part of a minority community suffering discrimination. One TV critic has described the series as the Addams Family meets the Dukes of Hazzard as written by Anne Rice. It is an assertion that emphasizes both the sensationalist Southern genres out of which the show is configured and the representations of Southern family and community that still infuse them. Cable TV series show Southerners as swamp people, gator people, redneck people, hillbilly people, drawn with broad brush strokes, even more noteworthy because so many of them are reality shows. At least many such contemporary representations of the South in the media are played for laughs. My favorite is the character of Kenneth Parcell, the intensely moral goofball who is the NBC page in 30 Rock, the comedy show. Certainly a stereotype of white Southerner, but he is a lovable and simple Southerner, an old type of the simple Southerner. When asked what he finds funny, he answers, "The usual, I suppose, two hobos sharing a bean, lady airline pilots." Just goofy, goofy. That's how we're seen. Even more revealing of the media and the South in the 21st century is the article on internet representations of the South. Cyberspace was hailed early as a monolithic technology that, because of its rapid communication possibilities, would eliminate for the need for traditional geographic and cultural distinctions, such as those of Southern culture. This is the World Wide Web. Where's the room for the South? In reality, many information superhighways exist, and they run through and connect a multitude of different communities of expression, including regional expressions. The very names attached to internet sites reflect how people incorporate attachments to the South into their online identities. And they're endless if you just go on the web, www.southerner.org, www.dixieweb.com. Rather than signaling the end of the importance of regions, the internet and its many components, including web pages, listservs, chat rooms, blogs, and social networking sites, all of which the Filson is a part of. They have ushered in a new platform for representing, talking about, and even debating the South. As our article notes, these online representations together constitute a virtual South, a new laboratory for studying the continuing importance of the region within popular culture and the evolving nature of what it means to be Southern within a global economy and a global society. Many of the representations of the South on the internet involve humor, and much of this humor represents Southerners, again, as simple, unsophisticated backwoods characters continuing that tradition that dates back to the region's frontier days. Internet humorists are fond of exaggerating the distinctiveness of Southern speech and have produced an online hickophonics to English dictionary. To assist in translating the term boss to boss, tire to tower, and barbed wire to barbed wire. For other internet humorists, the focus is not on reproducing the stereotypical dialects of the region, but in defining the general content of Southern conversations. The top 40 things you would never hear a Southerner say, supposedly, is a narrative frequently found on the internet. Supposedly, Southerners would never say, "I'll take Shakespeare for $1,000, Alex." They would never say, "Wrestling's fake," or "unsweetened tea tastes better." As access to internet technology broadens geographically and socially, the virtual South is increasingly a foundation for the expression of identity. A key term, of course, when you think about the South. What is the Southern identity? What is the nature of that? A Google search reveals that phrases such as "I am a Southerner" and "I am from the South" appear frequently in cyberspace. The South is fond and personal ways comes in response to moving away from the region often. An interesting example of this is the Southern Gal Goes North blog, in which an Alabama-raised wine consultant now living in Chicago archives her region-based memories and writings. Other identity-related depictions of the South take a much more political tone, as the internet is used as an arena for debating heritage and history in all sorts of ways. And the use of hyperlinks connecting all of this makes for a kind of virtual community. Let's look at two volumes of the new encyclopedia in terms of material suggestive of our theme of this 21st century South. The first volume in the series that we published was the one on religion, reflecting that we see religion as really an enduring cultural influence in the South. The dominance of evangelical Protestant groups in the South dates back to the early 19th century, and if someone had been pondering 200 years ago, in 1813, the future of the 19th century South, they would have been wise to see the spread of Baptist and Methodist to overwhelming religious hegemony by the time of the Civil War, because that's what happened. Their numbers grew even larger after the Civil War, as religious affiliation became a kind of badge of Southern identity. The period after World War II witnessed enormous changes in the South as one regional landmark after another vanished. But the dominance of evangelical churches remained, tying the later 20th century culture to the old-time religion. Surely the South remained the Bible Belt, even in the changing South of the late 20th century. A 1998 poll revealed that almost 2 out of 10 Southerners went to worship services more than once a week, more than twice the rate for people not from the South. More Southerners said they believed in God, 87%, compared to 41% of non-Southerners, twice as many, say that religion is extremely important to them, 80% to 30% of non-Southerners. The role of the white evangelical Protestant churches, African-American churches, and the new Christian right in presidential elections in the last 20 years suggests a heightened religious engagement with politics. This evidence of the continued vitality of the traditional religion must be seen, though, in light of a changing Southern context in the late 20th century and early 21st century. Prosperity, secularization, the role of the media and technology, all are broad forces that are obstacles to the maintenance of traditional ways in the 21st century South in general, and especially so in terms of religion. These supposedly contribute to the declining significance of religion, though, wearing away at it, but that's not always the case in the South. One of our articles suggests that the growth of suburbs has contributed in the recent South to the phenomenal increase of mega churches, which may spread as a particular 21st century form of Southern religiosity. Some of these congregations occupy former sports arenas. Others build new campuses or expand old ones. They offer coffee shops, sports activities, and musical concerts for the 2,000 or more people who attend weekly services. Mega churches are not exclusively Southern, but it is estimated that half of all mega churches in the United States are located in Southern metropolitan areas. They tend to be prevalent in sprawl cities, such as Atlanta, Houston, and Orlando. This 21st century church form is far from the old Brush Arbor and Camp Meeting revival, but the message is still a warm one of the blessed assurances that can come from the faith. The coming of new peoples and religions, though, has brought new challenges to evangelical Protestants in the South. Perhaps the most important statistic one might remember, reflecting the specifically religious impact, is about immigration. Over 20% of Southerners are now affiliated with a non-Protestant faith, whether Catholicism, Judaism, Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, or another faith. Of course, there are still more Baptists than people in the South. It is striking that Buddhism may be growing at a more rapid rate, though, than the Southern Baptist Convention. This is partly because of the decline of splitting off of the Southern Baptist Convention into various groups, but the rise of Buddhist population from Southeast Asian immigration, but also the appeal of Buddhist meditation centers for Southerners themselves as a kind of supplement often to whatever formal religion they might have. Recent estimates are that 26% of American Muslims live in the South. Special attention should be given, of course, to Latino immigration to the South. Recent immigration to the Deep South and Atlantic Coast South has augmented traditional Latino populations in Texas and Florida. The Catholic bishops of the South have faced tremendous challenges in supplying resources, whether Spanish-speaking priests, larger facilities, or social services that immigrants often go to, Catholic churches seeking. The ever-proselytizing Baptists have opened productive new evangelical work among Latinos, and the Pentecostals have been even more successful, building on their long work in Latin America. These changes in the 21st century are reflected in a changing landscape in the South. To be sure, evangelical Protestantism continues to mark the landscape, whether with the once pervasive white clapboard churches in the countryside or the more substantial brick edifices in cities. Three crosses evoking the crucifixion are scattered across the southern roadside, and small poignant roadside crosses mark automobile deaths in many southern states, a particularly evangelical way to remind whoever sees them of the need to get right with God. Indeed, roadside signs saying, "Jesus saves," or "Prepare to meet thy God," reflect this evangelical aesthetic as well. I saw one sign in Mississippi recently. It was a printed sign that said, "Prepare to meet thy God," but hand-lettered under it was, "Last chance." And church fans remain a part not only of the evangelical South, but emblems of Southern life in general. So I collect these fans, so I brought a few of them to show you. Now, these go back, of course, to the old palm fan that before air conditioning, these were air conditioning, of course. Then in the early 20th century, new improvements in lithography made these cardboard fans possible. And they're on a stick. And they're portable. And so these were very inexpensive to buy in bulk, and businesses would buy them and distribute them. And of course, you know which businesses did, funeral homes and insurance companies. This is a very peaceful scene. This is a church in autumn. So my theory is that the Southern image of heaven is on these fans. Here's a very, very peaceful scene of what heaven will be like. Imagine you're in a hot Southern church in August. Surely heaven is this cool mountain scene. That's what heaven's going to be like. It says the Bible Belt, folks, so you put a Bible on your fan. Now, any business could buy these, and so sometimes the image would not be matched on the back. This is a very sacred image of Jesus, but on the back it says, "Stop, rest, eat, and sleep at Howard's Snack Bar and Motel." So the climate was a common problem for blacks and whites. So you found black churches as well as white churches have fans and have images. This little girl has it. Go to church. Get right to the point. In the back of this, it says, "Kishon Funeral Home, air-conditioned ambulance." Dr. King was a frequent image on fans in African-American churches. I found this old one. Of course, I'm on eBay buying this stuff. And this is Booker T. Washington reading the Bible. This is from the Herbert Smith Funeral Home. Now, in the course of the 20th century, these fans moved out of the church tradition even, out of the Protestant tradition. A friend of mine went to the dedication of the Memphis Jewish Home, which was in June, and had to have a fan. So now they've moved into recreational activities. Here's one I got at Little League baseball game. You go to a watermelon festival, it's hot, you need a fan. We use it for tourism in Mississippi. Highway 61 will take you into the heart of the Mississippi Delta. We put our celebrities on these fans. Here's Minnie Pearl. And on the back it says, howdy. Mahalia Jackson, the nice stained glass on the back here. Here's Scarlett on a stick. Scarlett O'Hara. And of course, I can't talk about the South without talking about Elvis. In the back it says Elvis fan. Wasn't me. So all of these forms of tradition are still around in various ways. We can see the strong imprint of traditional Southern religion, but our religion volume reminds us that these traditional visual markings of the Southern landscape remain, but they're joined by newer symbols reflecting the hard-to-miss presence of new faiths. Our Lady of Guadalupe is displayed on candles bought in general grocery stores. Her image is displayed on the back windows of pickup trucks and in other venues of public display that are appropriate to the new Latino immigration, because Our Lady of Guadalupe is, of course, the patron saint of Mexico. As our editor of the religion volume, Samuel Hill, writes, we note the Hindu temples, Buddhist centers, and Muslim mosques that have become a feature of the landscape. Large cities may contain several of these non-traditional religious houses. Meditation centers and retreat houses have sprung up here and there, sometimes holding attraction for Christians who are drawn to meditative practices, as I've said. Demographically and culturally, the American South grows steadily more like the rest of the nation in its interaction with global civilization. Hill closes his overview essay with that passage, and it particularly striking in its reference to global civilization. Remember Senator Rhett's Civil War praise of the imagined future South. Little could he have imagined the South adapting to the global civilization of the 21st century. Let's look at conversation among some of our editors. As in closing tonight, I discovered as I was looking at the volumes, all 24, looking at the overview essays that they wrote, many of them ended their volumes by speculating with summary thoughts on such issues as the Southern identity and the very survival of the Southern culture in the 21st century. The editor of the politics essays, Bradley Bond, notes, although the ethos of economic growth has seemingly cured many of the South's political ills, the legacy of Jim Crow, disfranchisement, and one-party politics remain, suggesting Woodward's burdens from the past are ongoing into the future. Yet, he adds, the South seems hardly peculiar anymore. Indeed, the region is part of a broad belt of so-called red states that lean toward conservatism. In those states, concern is palpable that citizens have been left behind by the emerging global economy. Anxious citizens and politicians lash out at immigrants, big government, and a host of isms. Bond sees the need to move beyond what he calls an antiquated vision of economic growth that privileges smokestacks and traditional manufacturing, the service industries, and a suburban development. Developing an entrepreneurial creative economy and investing in equitable allocation of resources to a broad citizenry are his hopes for the South's future. Yet he remains pessimistic. Writing, all things considered, one finds it difficult to imagine such a transformation, and it is equally difficult to imagine a transformation taking place in similarly situated regions elsewhere in the country. Likely, the South will continue, as it has been over the last two decades, to embrace a political ideology not particularly distinctive or particularly Southern. So he's pretty pessimistic about a Southern survival of identity. If Bond is pessimistic about the South's future, our editors of the Folklife volume, Glenn Hill Henson and our old colleague Bill Ferris, are optimistic that contemporary changes presage a creative renewal in the 20th century South. As the South increasingly claims its place within the national and global economy, they write, the region has come to host an ever-increasing stream of cultural outsiders. Many of these newcomers arrive here singly as individuals and families. Many more arrive as communities, bringing with them the richness of their own home-based traditions. As the numbers increase, so do their influence on the cultural flow within the South. Southern Baptist churches now share the streets with Latino Pentecostal congregations. Barbecue joints vie for customers with taco stands and Indian restaurants. Fairgrounds that once hosted only agricultural fairs, tractor pulls, bluegrass festivals, and gun shows now also feature Latino rodeos and Vietnamese New Year celebrations. Many of the newcomers are from the North and bringing shopping malls, fast food restaurants, and many of these things. In many of the South's urban areas, bagel shops now outnumber cafes that sell fresh biscuits, while coffee shops and New York-style sub shops are giving luncheonettes and fried chicken joints a run for their money. As many Southerners are increasingly apt to say, the South is getting harder and harder to find. But our editors suggest Southerners have been saying that same thing for generations, bemoaning the passing of a past memorialized in memory and often located in a highly selective miscellany of practices and institutions. It's always worth remembering that Southerners were singing songs like, "Give me that old-time religion," in the late 1800s. They thought everything had changed. There was no more old-time religion. Yet throughout many changes, whether radio, television, air conditioning, throughout all of these, the South has managed to hold on to its distinct regional identity. Indeed, if we were to measure the strength of this identity by the vitality of the region's folk life, we would probably conclude that this identity not only is at no risk of disappearing, but is in fact alive, well, and absolutely thriving. If anything, the rush of new cultural streams is stirring the waters in ways that only increase the opportunities for novel, yet still singularly Southern, commingling and creativity. Well, in wrapping things up, one sees a region, I think, that looking through the new Encyclopedia of Southern Culture, that will still struggle with holdovers from older burdens of Southern history in some cases. But Southerners will do so in evolving, reconfigured context of broadened space beyond North-South conflicts or even just American context. Much evidence from the new Encyclopedia assures us that many Southern traditions from the past will adapt and survive. Consider Kentucky. I know you will consider Kentucky. Consider the Kentucky Derby, Burgoo, and Bourbon. These emblems of Southernness, I think, in Kentucky have long tied Kentucky to the Southern culture and will likely continue to do so. Burgoo, for example, is long regarded as a local Kentucky delicacy. But thanks to food writers like John T. Edge and others, thanks to many extensive cookbooks of regional food beyond Kentucky, and thanks to internet recipes, I would argue that burgoo is better known now than ever by a wide audience and probably cooked in all sorts of places that think about Kentucky as this is a Kentucky-defining feature. Consider bourbon. That liquid amber has not only become a state tourist treasure in the bourbon belt, but bourbon sales are expanding in Europe and especially in Asia. Consider the Kentucky Derby, a defining feature of not only Kentucky culture, but also Southern culture. We now have Middle Eastern horse people, and the sport has long had Latin American jockeys tying it to a transnational context of the 21st century. All of these are examples, I think, of Kentucky continuing to be Southern, continuing to have these local traditions that are Southern traditions as well, that will adapt to the 21st century. Now, historians like me are hesitant to speculate on the future, but you've noticed how much fun I've had doing it tonight, drawing from ideas from our contributors to the New Encyclopedia of Southern Culture. One has to be tentative when you think about thinking about the 21st century South. But I'm drawn to one of the wisest remarks I know about the South by the African-American writer Albert Murray, whose 1970s memoir, South to an Old Place, was part of that decade's hopeful post-segregation take on the South's future. In that 1976 Time magazine article, a special issue that I mentioned on the South that had Woodward's article on the Southern future, Murray wrote of the tentativeness of predicting the future. "These things always go up and down," he wrote. "As a Southerner, my main response is through the blues. The nature of the blues is improvisation. You must be ready for all eventualities." Amen. Thank you. So, questions? Have any questions? Is Kentucky Southern? There's a good one. I have one. Yes.
How is President Obama faring in the New South, and why so?
Good question. I think, our politics now is so polarizing in general, and so he's in the middle of this polarization, basically, is, I think, the short answer. He was elected the first time in 2008. He broke the solid South, you know, in terms of winning Virginia, North Carolina, and Florida, and that was noteworthy of that. He's building on a base politically that is seen by hopeful Democrats as the future because of the rising Latino population that they hope will vote Democratic and continuing African-American influx into the South. As we talk about the Latino coming to the South, but often it's not noted that the African-American return population is very dramatically high beginning about 2000. And so this is the kind of hope for the Democratic Party that Obama will be able to put together a coalition in the South. Now, on the other hand, clearly white Southerners vote against the Democratic Party, President Obama, and are an important coalition. The rise of the Tea Party has influenced that as well. So I think you've got this polarization. I think that among African Americans, he is an extraordinary hero for understandable reasons. I mean, here's this fellow that symbolizes the rise of African Americans in American society. He doesn't have a strong base in the South, you know, in terms of his advisors, in terms of his political base, and all of this. So it's a challenge. I think the South is a challenge for him in these polarizing times.
Barack Obama's great-great-grandfather was a man named Thomas Lewis from Bourbon County, Kentucky.
Whoa. Good question. I grew up in Texas, of course. So The question is about Texas. Is Texas really Southern? How integrated is Texas into the rest of the South, for example? And she mentioned the secession, the talk of Texas secession. Texas actually, when it entered the Union, has this provision that it can, if it wants, divide into five states. This is the only state when it entered the Union thought of this. I remember in the 70s, during the oil crisis, there were bumper stickers in Texas, "Texas oil for Texans, secession now." But Texas, you know, is a geographical and cultural place, is half Southern and half Western. I mean, there you can chart the line, you know, the longitude. That east of it looks like the rest of the South. East Texas is piney woods. It's hot and humid. It was a major cotton-growing area before the Civil War. White Southerners settled it and brought their slaves, so it's slave country. But if you go west of that 100th meridian, you find dry landscape, arid country, just like much of the West. You find a very small African-American population because slavery, cotton wasn't grown back then, west in that arid area. You find large Latino population as distinct from African-American. So it's really two states, at least two states in a lot of different ways. Now, I think it's really a kind of region that you might call the Southern Crossroads region that Texas is a part of, that has Oklahoma and maybe parts of Missouri, Southern Missouri and Arkansas, that is a very distinctive kind of place from the rest of the South. It has a stronger, I think, you know, it's hard to talk about survival of the frontier in the 21st century, but in some ways I think it is a kind of frontier attitudes that's individualism and all of this in Texas. If you look at Rick Perry, I mean, he's like a frontier individualist to me. Texas, it's a great question because it's never fit very comfortably with the rest of the South. It was a Confederate state, so it has that Confederate history. But after the war, the Texas economy went on a different route because of oil. and much more money than the rest of the South. It never had the kind of poverty that the rest of the South did in a lot of ways. And ranching became such a successful, gave a diversity to the economy beyond just the cotton growing of East Texas. So is Kentucky Southern? We have 100% approval here. Very good. We had a scientific poll tonight.
But is Louisville Southern?
That's not so sure. Yes. Yes, sir.
You mentioned both Churchill Downs and Our Lady of Guadalupe.
Yes.
And there is a chunk on inside church.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, that's the polarized South as well.
But it's in a little building outside.
It has its own little grotto. Yes. Okay. So it's there. So here's that's an interesting image. You know, it's there, but it's separate.
Yeah. It's way in the back.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.